listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. Okay, everybody, this is Brian Callen, and my guest is none other than what's a good adjective for you, Vincent? The incomparable Vincent La Barbera. And I'm going to post a picture of you because you wear an eye patch. You've got a shock, and I mean a shock, a mane of gray hair. You're a silver fox, my friend.
I just got a cut for you, Brian.
I appreciate that for this podcast. That's what I'm talking about. We've had we just had lunch, and I always love talking to you because you're such a you're not just a well-read guy, but you have a what I really appreciate about you, and is, can I say your age? Does it matter?
I'm going to be 59 in April.
You're 59, and you're so far from having slowed down. You went snowblind 3 times because you were a big-time mountain climber. You were a war photographer, I believe.
Wouldn't I chased them, but I was not a war photographer.
Okay, you chased wars, and you went snowblind 3 times because you would climb mountains like what? Did you climb, what were the big mountains?
This is what we're talking about?
Well, don't worry. I'm setting the stage for you because I'm doing your bio.
I climbed Gondjalachuli and Langtang and various other minor peaks.
Just big peaks. And you wear an eye patch over one eye as a result. But I guess what I find so refreshing about you, and one of the reasons I love to spend time with you, you're a trial lawyer. You take on difficult cases. You take on big cases. You're in one now, and we're going to talk about that. But you're as close to a movie character. I mean, Michael Douglas would play you in the life of your movie. That's who we'd have to. It'd either be Harvey Keitel's too old at this point, but it'd be Michael Douglas. I think that's the actor that I would choose. Maybe even De Niro. Although you're bigger than De Niro, you're just a bigger man than De Niro. So I think Douglas would be a good choice.
Well, you write the screenplay.
I'm going to. Sean Penn, if he needs another 10 years, Sean Penn could play you. And maybe now, maybe right now. But you are somebody who I very much appreciate because you have such a strong sense of justice. You are outraged by the injustices in the world. And we're going to get to what I mean by that. But you're a very important person, I think. And I wanted to get you on the podcast to voice your philosophy and what you think is wrong with our justice system and maybe what's even wrong with our national conscience, that the way we think about things is antiquated. The way we think about drugs is antiquated. The way we think about meeting out justice is antiquated. We were talking, you were very heatedly about the National Defense Authorization Act, which I know a lot of listeners that listen to this podcast, and certainly the ones on Joe Rogan's podcast, he's always talking about this act, are outraged by the fact that you can kill an American citizen. And all you need is somebody in the Defense Department who's a high-ranking official, or for that matter in the administration, someone, to okay that operation, to look at the evidence and say, yeah, that's fine, let's kill him. And I'm speaking specifically about the incident when, I can't remember his name, but the Al-Qaeda, the guy who was not even an Al-Qaeda guy, but he was rather a cleric in Yemen who was advocating what was his name?
I think it's Alawaki.
Alawaki, that's exactly what his name was. And they killed him and his son. His son grew up in Colorado. So, without any due process or anything else. And
I'm not happy about whether they're an American citizen or not. It seems easier to talk about when people, I guess, get more outraged when we say you can even kill an American citizen under this act without any due process. Mm. But I don't know why it makes any difference whether a person's an American citizen or not. The notion that there's no checks and balances on some executive's power and choices as to who deserves to be killed and who doesn't deserve to be killed. The progression, from what I can tell, is without a formal declaration of war, the executive branch now gets to essentially declare a war. They declare a war on many things. They declare a war on terrorism. It's an international war. There's no boundaries. And then that allows us to violate other countries' national boundaries, where if they did that to us, what would we do?
Right.
And then because we've declared a war under the rules of war and the rules of engagement, there's going to be certain things that are permissible that wouldn't be permissible if you weren't in a state of war. For instance, bombing. So then you get to have a drone attack, and that's authorized. And then anybody who dies who's an innocent person is collateral damage. And so that's what war has become. And, of course, the argument in support of that is that this is the way asymmetrical warfare
right.
has to be fought right. because warfare is not conventional any longer.
Well, I was gonna say that, and I'm glad you said it, because I just read The Looming Tower, Lawrence Wright's book. I recommend to everybody. He won a Pulitzer Prize for basically exhaustive study on Al-Qaeda, the creation of Al-Qaeda. He actually goes back to this the birth of the Islamic fundamentalism, this movement, which happened in Egypt under a guy named Sayyid Qutb, but in the 50s. But he traces it to what happened in 9/11. And it's a fascinating book. But what's one of the things you take from the book is that the FBI and the CIA both had information that could have helped each other. The FBI, however, is a very different agency than the CIA. The FBI is basically an agency that collects information and prosecutes. The CIA's job, in many ways, is not only to collect information, but to run military operations based on that intelligence. And those military operations, I'm using a euphemism a lot of times, is to kill that particular person. We tried to kill bin Laden many times with cruise missiles and things based on you know, various intelligence. But it does bring you to, you know, the debate is, and I think I know where you fall on it, and after reading the book I may fall on it too, on this side too, is when you have evidence that a terrorist cell is trying to plot to kill people, innocent people, is a team of assassins appropriate, or do you just like a police operation, collect that evidence and come down and capture them and bring them to justice? I know the military's argument or the CIA's argument, at least some of the people would say, sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes you can't, with Al-Awlaki, you can't go into Yemen. It is sovereign space. You can't have a snatch team to take that guy to justice because of 1,000, you know, variables. Yet he's orchestrating or influencing young men to go and kill people. I do think that I can give you both sides of the argument. I do think it's very important to choose a side. I do think that it's a very important debate to have. And I do think that it is an idea that is worth fighting for and winning. And I happen to fall on your side, the notion that this country is great because we give due process. This country is great because we give people a fair trial. This country is great because we don't have secret meetings by which we are deciding whether or not somebody should live or die. I don't know who those people are. I don't know who is making those decisions. And if you pick up a history book, you know that anytime this kind of stuff happens, government just gets more and more irresponsible, more and more drunk with power, and the situation gets worse and worse.
The exception doesn't make the rule. This is not a difficult thing to analyze. You can't, in my opinion, formulate foreign policy based on the exception. Because otherwise, what makes us different from anybody else? And then why are we the special God-given choice? That because if another country conducted themselves in the same fashion against us, what would we do to that country?
That we would
decimate them.
That's right.
So the notion that we can do all of these, foreign policy is a very complicated thing. All I object to is that the notion of due process, the notion of assassination, the notion of collateral damage on an essentially undeclared war. Congress has never declared war. In that circumstance, what I object to is that becomes our actual policy. Mm-hmm. We actually develop statutes that allow that to occur. Because if that's the case, and I don't want to overstate this, but all that government allows us to do then is make small choices. Maybe they're not small to some small interest group.
It's what do you very mean by that? That's interesting.
We have national debates over things that are very, very important. Let's say gays' right to marry. Mm. Those are the choices that we get to have debates over. We don't have debates over whether it's appropriate to have a guy in Langley playing with a
Langley,
war game.
By the way, being CIA headquarters.
Playing war games on a computer, directing a drone half a world away to drop a bomb on a village full of people because there's one guy in there that we want to kill, or five guys in there that we want to kill. If that's what we're all about, well, I'm not very happy about it.
Mm. You shouldn't be. And in all fairness to people in Langley, I know, and I've talked to the, you know, this guy was a Delta Force guy who was probably an operative after that, but I know that
I told you I couldn't disagree more.
I know, and I love it. You did. Tom Bigley is that last podcast, and you didn't. You had big problems with, you know. He's a soldier, though. I mean, he's an elite soldier whose job in many ways is to think that way. I mean, he can't be too nuanced or complicated about the job that he's given because he's kind of the elbow of our foreign policy. Guys like that.
He's a SEAL team guy, and he's got to be. That's right. I've defended Marines. In the theater of war, those people are heroes. They're not formulating policy.
Right.
They can't formulate policy. Right. They have to take orders.
Right. But in the Lumen
Tower, I guess
Tower,
they have to find a moral compass that allows them to do the things that they do in order to live.
Tom himself, and in the Looming Tower, you see this. You know, there were situations where they could have killed a certain high value target. They didn't because, in fact, they were in a house full of kids. The people in those rooms are very aware of that. However,
that's right. Because you know why?
Yeah.
Because there's a man on the ground making a human decision.
Right.
Versus a robot in the sky with a guy 6,000 miles away who's got a throttle stick. And he's just dropping a bomb because he can't make those on-the-ground decisions. Asymmetrical warfare has created a world in which we can play war games on computers and kill people thousands of miles from where we live.
That's right.
And there's no moral judgments being made at all. And when the killing becomes that far removed, I mean, how do we justify Hiroshima? Well, there's some great arguments about that. And Dresden, because that's collateral. See, this is... Maybe I skipped over too quickly. That's the concept of collateral damage. Once you declare war, then the rules of war apply, and there's going to be collateral damage.
Yes.
So all you have to do is declare a war. You can declare a war on drugs, which they've done. Tremendous waste of money and manpower.
And you defend a lot of people. We're going to get to that. All drugs should be legal.
Everything should be legal. On a cost-benefit analysis... and we can show you studies that show that addiction rates don't go up or go down based upon whether something's legal or illegal.
I believe that.
But there's an entire infrastructure that's built up around the war on drugs. There's an entire military-industrial complex that's built up around war.
Mm-hmm.
So we
war is big business.
We have been in constant state of war since World War II. We've never not been in war. Mm. And Eisenhower warned us against the military-industrial complex, and they run the country.
Right.
I would suspect, I'm not very happy with Mr. Obama, but I suspect any president has to, once they find out the information that we don't know, once they get into the White House, has to recognize who really runs things.
Well, you know, I would recommend to most people, I've said this before on the podcast, Lawrence Lessig wrote a book called Republic Lost about what campaign finance and what money in politics has done to our republic and how it really becomes about the vested interests, those interests that have the most money are essentially the ones that are running this government. The argument then can be, you know, there are different – he comes up with different anecdotes for that, different cures for that that may or may not work. He's rather cynical in the book, but it brings me to the sort of – the root of the issue, you know, what you going back to what you started with saying was we talk about small things. We talk about gays in the military. We talk about gay people's right to marriage. We are not talking about big ideas. We're not talking about the ideas that affect an entire. It's kind of like putting dealing with a scraped knee or a wound that won't heal. And putting a bandaid on it when in fact the problem is your diabetes and that's why your blood isn't clotting, etc. And I think that's what I thought was very interesting about what you were saying is the idea that we should be talking about grand ideas. Barack Obama was, you know, one of the things I noticed about him is that, and I'm disappointed in, is that these drone attacks have stepped up under him. The National Defense Authorization Act has been signed on. He is a big government guy, as you said over lunch. This guy believes, trust me, I'm going to run things. You know, we are going to run things. He's a government bureaucrat. That's in his. I don't think he's a bad guy, but I think that's in his ingrained in who he is.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is I think he's a progressive guy, and that's how at least he's painted.
I probably believe everything he believes on social issues.
Right. Yet he it seems that inadvertently or maybe even on purpose, the government from a military point of view has become more secretive, more powerful, more effective.
You know what? I like to give people their arguments whenever I can. So let's give him his argument or give the military their argument or whoever formulates foreign policy their argument. Okay, we are in a war. What's the end game?
That's right. I know what they'll tell you.
There's an end game. Okay, what are they
going to do? The end game, I would imagine, is they want to keep Americans first, safe.
What does that mean?
Terrorism. That means we want to avoid 9/11 or worse.
Okay, so we then invaded. We didn't really invade Iraq for that reason. Mm-hmm. We didn't create, 500,000 casualties and the destruction of an entire country and infrastructure and 50 years of an entire country hating us. Mm-hmm. But we went into Afghanistan ostensibly after Al-Qaeda because they or Osama bin Laden caused 9/11. So now we're fighting in Pakistan because they went to Pakistan. We are going to leave. The Taliban will retake power, or some other warlord, but probably the Taliban. Al-Qaeda is moved to Yemen.
You know, even to stop you, when you say the Taliban will take power, it's so interesting because Taliban just means student. In Arabic, or maybe it's in Dari or in Farsi, but Talib means student, and so you know the Taliban is going to take power. What's going to take power is the vacuum we have left. Is the fact that country has been so destroyed. Is the fact that the only thing that matters is who has the guns, and whoever does have the guns, the people that rise to power. Yes, you're right. They're going to take over power. That's what's interesting about. We go into Iraq, we destabilize entire country, and Maliki, who is turning into a mini Saddam.
Exactly.
He's got police forces reporting to him. But continue. I'm sorry, but continue.
No, so I was in Afghanistan and Pakistan in 83, and when the Russians were there. The region itself is unstable, but what we didn't do anything to stabilize it. That's what I'm trying to say. So what's the end game? How are we being made safer? Every time we... There's an entire generation of villagers and young men who have no future, who have watched their cousins and their mothers be killed. And when we leave, that vacuum will be filled again. And what was accomplished? Trillions of dollars of debt, the loss of an entire generation of Marine and soldier, and Al-Qaeda moves to Mali. Or moves to Yemen, it'll move to Somalia. So, therefore, our foreign policy is to traipse around the world and drop drones bombs on people all around the world. And is that making us safer? And they would say, yes, we haven't had an attack on our soil since 9/11. What if we changed the paradigm? What if we rejected the premise and our foreign policy wasn't the kind of foreign policy that would create a personality that would want to come and bomb us just because we are who we are.
Well, I don't know that that's realistic because I think that the United States, as powerful as they are, and any country that's as powerful as they are, any country that has the kind of vested interest that we have all over the world, it's almost impossible not to create some enemies. And I will say, after reading The Looming Tower, that the rise of Islamic fundamentalism probably had more to do with the Soviets in some ways, and certainly the repressive regimes that, albeit the United States supported in response to the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but the oppressive governments, the dictatorships, the military dictatorships of Egypt, for example, and just religious zeal, men who were living in countries where they felt so insignificant that they turned to this notion of religion being the end all and be all, and especially a military fundamentalist belief system that gave them a sense of purpose, was a justification for their anger, that gave them the backdrop and the scaffolding to support their attacks. That probably would have existed anyway, because even in the 90s, nobody really took this Muslim fundamentalism very seriously. It was only a handful of people in the FBI that knew that. Well, these are very important questions that you're raising.
I think
you draw the lines. We do have a CIA, we do have an FBI, we do have a military, because they are there. To provide protection from threats, whatever they might be in this country. Yes, as a country, you need to make sure you're not creating more enemies. You're right.
So we're going to accept that we're really not a democracy. The National Defense Authorization Act allows for a detention without a warrant for any person that is believed to be a terrorist or associates with a terrorist. They never have to be brought in front of a judge. They never have to have a trial. Indefinite detention. No due process. Nobody gets to review this decision, and they just sit there. The danger is in the wording of the statute that could be anybody, because, and that's why journalists dislike it so much, because they, you know, there's a great movie that my son turned me on to called Shooting Robert King, and he's a war photographer. He is a war photographer. Mm-hmm. And he tells the story, because he was in Chechnya, and he was in Bosnia, and he was also embedded in Iraq. And he says that when he was in Iraq embedded, the story that he told necessarily, because he was embedded, was through the eyes of the troops, versus when he was in Chechnya, when he was in Bosnia, he was with the people. And so he could tell a different story. He could photograph a different story. He could show the horrors of war in a different way. Because inevitably, and I learned this myself, based upon a case that I had, that you become emotionally attached to the people that you're with. So when I represent a Marine, I'm emotionally attached to that Marine. And so I'm going to defend him based upon his actions in the theater.
And I should tell the listeners, you did defend Marines in the Fallujah case, didn't you?
I did. A Marine with some other remarkable men, Kevin McDermott, Doug Applegate, Joe Prius.
And got them off, didn't you?
One man. We only represented Jose Nazario, and he was acquitted, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know, where was I?
You were just talking about the notion of the National Defense Authorization
Act. Oh, yeah.
Act.
So a journalist, then, who is not embedded, who chooses to go out into the field and live amongst the people. Now, Robert King, by the way, was kidnapped, and they were going to behead him, but the local sheiks kept him from being beheaded because of his relationship to the people on the ground. Is he an associate of terrorists because he's shooting from their perspective? Is he an associate of terrorists because he's writing from their perspective? And can that person be detained indefinitely? Could that person never see a judge?
That the answer is that's up to some guy that we'll never see, yeah, in the administration or in the Defense Department, right?
Yeah, and my problem is that is now policy. That is actually adopted policy.
Amazing. It's amazing to me. When you say it, and I know you're a lawyer and you follow this stuff, I can't believe it. Like, I have trouble believing it. But this is the country that we're
Facebook
living in.
Look at my Facebook
page. Yeah. Yeah, I will. What is the Facebook page? Like, you post a lot of this stuff.
That's all I post. It's just my name.
Vincent La Barbera. All right. Yeah. This is the fight worth having. So what do we do about it?
Well, I think that first we have to have a paradigm shift in our thinking. So I don't know. The answer is I don't know. We don't know what we don't know. But, you know, I wrote a line in a poem a long time ago. It was, salvation is not spelled C-O-K-E or C-H-R-I-S-T. I don't know how it is spelled. Only a few ways it isn't. I don't know how salvation is spelled, but I sure know a few ways it isn't spelled.
That's an important thing.
I think we just struggle with this stuff because...
But you just said it. I mean, you said to an extent, and we were talking about a little bit about this over lunch, there has to be a shift in our paradigm. There has to be a shift in our thinking, the way you beat a bad idea is with a good idea, a better idea, right?
And you just keep talking about it. You don't give up. You don't get tired.
You keep debating.
You don't get embarrassed. Yeah. You just keep... Because somebody's got to.
My father used to always say, there's always an answer. Don't be an intellectual. Don't talk in circles. Find the answer. It's a hard thing to do, but you got to have an
answer.
We
don't live in a world of problem solvers, do we?
But you have to. If you don't win the day with your argument and you don't win it fairly with real and reasoned debate, then in my opinion, that's where the guilt lies. That's why thinking and being aware of what's going on in your world and knowing, first of all, where the problem lies, what the root of the problem is. You have to isolate that before you can fight it. You've got to know where the problem is.
In some respects, if we were concerned only with outcomes, with succeeding, with winning, we wouldn't be heroic. That's what makes man heroic. His struggle against injustice, whether he's going to win or he's going to lose, because he has no other choice. You just get up every day and you do it.
You know, Martin Sheen, one time I was doing West Wing, and we were talking about Guilty by Suspicion, the movie during the McCarthy era, where they blacklisted a lot of Hollywood directors and actors who wouldn't give up names.
Right.
And I said,
Ronald Reagan did.
Yeah. Well, I was that's right. And I was eating lunch, and Martin Sheen was there, and there was Martin Sheen. It's kind of exciting. And I said, well, it's tough. You never know how you're going to behave in that situation. And Martin Sheen said, yeah, you do. You sure do. And when you behave properly, or you behave improperly, it just compounds who you really are.
That's
I
exactly
never
right.
forgot that.
Because all we really have is ourselves and our integrity. So I have I like to say this to my kids. I can't teach you all the little rules and regulations that you have to follow in your life. You know, you innately know what's right and you innately know what's wrong. It might be hard, but you know. You know the right decision the minute that if you're conscious, that is, the minute that the situation occurs that you have to make a right or wrong decision. And that's all life is, a bunch of decisions. Mm-hmm. Every single day you get up and you just make decisions. If you're involved, if you're engaged in life.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I don't know the answer.
But that's where when you see, we have these conversations, and that's when you realize that you can't avoid political commitment. If you have to make a political commitment, which really means you have to make a philosophical commitment.
That's right.
And if you don't do that, you are going to be a plaything. You are going to be used as either a tool or as fodder.
Well, the challenge is that we don't have a free press. A very few group of organizations control all the media, and that media is very careful as to what news it puts out. I mean, do we know what's going on in Greece right now?
No.
Do we know what's going on anywhere in the world right now other than the little few stories that, I mean, how much real news is put out there?
Well, that's why I try to listen to the BBC and, you know, this.
But even that, I mean, you got to go into the deep web and use proxies to get information.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I'm a strong supporter of Julian Assange. But the government and government, our government in particular, they don't want that. They do not want us to know.
No.
And but that's a whole. Yeah, Julian's in a whole other story.
What is going on with Julian Assange? Do you know?
Yeah. He's holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And if he leaves, the United States is going to snatch him up and probably try him as a fucking terrorist.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and so he's
the guy, Julian Assange. Everybody is the guy who I think created WikiLeaks, didn't he? Yeah, created WikiLeaks, and
he's being accused of trumped up charges in Sweden. And
yeah, sexual.
That's a whole nother. Yeah, sexual. He had consensual sex with two women, and his condom broke.
Wow.
Let's not even go into it. It's just it's absurd. It's absurd. It's worthy of a movie.
You know, you are a guy who defends a lot of times those that a lot of people have already made up their mind about, not in a very favorable way. I know it's got to be emotionally exhausting. You're in the middle of a trial right now, for with I think representing a woman who whose son recently not only committed suicide but killed some people before he did so. Shot a girl in the face and then went on to kill two other people, I think, and then finally took his own life. You're representing her in a hit-and-run case?
Yeah, in a case. The trial hasn't started. There will be a trial sometime.
Right, right.
Because she's completely innocent.
She's completely innocent.
She's absolutely innocent. It's very hard. You know, you would know that we've been approached by a lot of people because they just want to hear her story. Well, can you imagine? We talked about this at lunch. Can you imagine losing your child, period?
Right.
We both
No.
have kids.
No.
And this soon afterwards, the notion that we would parade her in front of people so that they could ask her questions, and everybody thinks that they have such, you know, high-minded intentions. Maybe she can impart some knowledge. Let her grieve.
Yeah.
Let the lady grieve.
Let her grieve.
She, the notion that somehow she's responsible for this, you know, we were talking about this before, is based upon a Middle Ages notion of for every event, there has to be a cause. And sometimes there is meaningless suffering. We talked about this. Dostoevsky talks
about
it.
So you're saying essentially that her son goes crazy, kills some people, kills himself, and there are a lot of people that are looking to blame someone. They want to blame the mother because it gives them some order in their life. There's the random things can't just happen.
That's right.
And you know, you were telling me a very moving story about your father who had an accident and lived a very undignified life in the latter years of his life, and you had to take care of him. I mean, he was paralyzed and all these things and had some brain damage, and you know, the story is very, very moving. But I would imagine that you were a very different person before that. And then when you you're so in the thick of things, you're so in the mix of things that you know, for you to say things like, hey, sometimes bad shit happens, there doesn't have to be a reason, at least not one that you can point to. Sometimes you can't connect the dots.
Ivan in the Brothers Karamazov asks that question: how could there be a God, and how could you reconcile that with the death of the holy innocents? You know, the story in the Bible that Herod sends out his army to kill all of the innocent children under the age of two because the Magi had told him that they had come to visit the king of the Jews and who was just born.
Right.
And that's the ultimate question of whether or not there can be such thing as meaningless suffering. You know, we've always lived in a paradigm of classical physics in our lifetime that one thing causes another thing, cause and effect.
Sure.
That is antiquated notion. We live in a, you know, we talked about this at lunch again. Max Planck came up with quantum theory over 100 years ago, and we're still living an antiquated paradigm. The cosmology we live in is that there is no such thing as meaning. We have to blame somebody. There is no such thing as random act.
It's heavily influenced by the Judeo-Christian ethic. I mean, it's heavily influenced by the idea of divine justice, hell and heaven, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah. Even Thomas Aquinas, I think, who said there's got to be a primary mover. I'll prove the existence of God because when you push a stone, you were the one that pushed it. Somebody got this globe a-spinning, and that had to have been God. Somebody, that had to have been a primary mover, right?
It's a fascinating conversation, but it begs the question because the notion... in other words, I don't believe in that, but let's just, because there's quantum theory, there's string theory, there's all kinds of things that are happening now, but let's just give those people that argument. That is a huge jump from a God who has a personal interest in the lives of his creations. Because if he does, I would be pretty damn disappointed in the, 75% of the world's population since the history of man has lived in utter degradation and misery.
Right.
So how do you answer that question? I have a simple answer. God has nothing to do with it.
Yeah. It's math.
I don't know what it is. I don't know how salvation is spelled only a few ways it isn't.
Yeah, I grew up, you know, all over the world, mostly in the developing world. And I remember being this white kid, you know, in a car and watching a bunch of kids my age come up and beg at the window. I couldn't figure out why the hell I was so lucky. You know, why me? You know, that's what got me asking things. I remember seeing a guy in Yemen who had leprosy who didn't have a nose or fingers.
Right.
And I was like, I just got lucky here, man. The fact that I was born American and white and with some money and healthy and all that. That's just where the math falls on your side. I didn't do anything to deserve that.
No, we got lucky, baby.
And,
you
that's
know,
right. That's it.
I walk around Bangladesh 40 years ago and,
wow.
And I would go out and I had very little on me, but I would say, okay, today is one arm and blind. Tomorrow is no legs. You know, in other words, you have to,
parcel out your charity.
I would weep if I had to actually.
It's exhausting.
Deal with the level of misery that there is.
That's right. I mean,
we don't see it. We do not see it. Nobody wants to see it. We have news is entertainment in this country.
That's right. So. That's exactly right. But it doesn't mean that you don't keep trying to find out where the problem is and you don't keep trying to fight for it, but you've got to be informed by it.
You just got to keep plugging along on an individual level.
When you defend somebody, and you've been defending, you're a real trial lawyer. I mean, you get evidence and it's like out of the movies. We've talked about what you define as a crime, why you take a certain case. I'm sure in many cases, the person did it, yet you fight just as hard to get them off. If it's a case of drugs, obviously, I know you think all drugs should be legal anyway, so you want the government to, you want to stick it to the government. I get that. But then there are other cases.
I don't want to stick it to anybody. I just don't think that a person's life should be ruined. You know, I heard Joe Rogan talk about this, and who's the guy from Penn & Teller?
One of the guys, his name is Penn or Teller.
Yeah, he's Penn. He's great, too. So let me get this straight. Barack Obama, there's serious evidence that Barack Obama, George Bush, and Bill Clinton at least puffed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's significant evidence that maybe they even sniffed.
Sure.
But they didn't get caught.
Right.
So they could become president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect they bought whatever they puffed or they snorted from somebody.
Sure.
It's the height of hypocrisy to ruin a young man's life because he sells anything or purchases and possesses anything. Because we live in the internet world right now. And so even if I win that case, or even if I don't get him jail time, even if we expunge the conviction at a later point in his life, the internet, it's never not on, it's done. He's never going to get, that's $1 million decision. You deal a dime bag, it's $1 million choice if you have a brain in your head, because you will never get a good job.
You'll never
be president of the United States. You will never be senator. You will never be a school teacher. You will never be a nurse. You will never be a lawyer. You'll never be a doctor.
That's incredible. What a waste. What a waste.
So that's the way I look at it. I don't want to stick it to anybody. I want these people, these young men, these young women, to have a life. And I think it's the height of hypocrisy for an administration. And I was asked by a young lady that I just hired. So you, therefore, during the interview process last week, so therefore you think that people can't change their minds. In other words, the presumption is so let's just say.
Once a bad person, always a bad person. Right?
No, that's not what I mean at all. I mean that they shouldn't be ruining other people's lives. And then, of course, we could have the debate on an economic level and on a moral level, and on a social level. But I don't think we have time for that right now. Mm. I just would talk about it on that level. It's just wrong.
Hmm.
It's just plain wrong. And I can understand that society, listen, you and I have had this conversation many times about big government versus small government. We all believe in government. I'm not an anarchist. I'm a minarchist. And a minarchist.
I like that.
Because
Vincent LaBarbera saying a minarchist, I'm going to steal that from you.
Because an anarchist is a person who believes in chaos. And we all, I think we accept the notion that we all want to drive on the same side of the street. I don't think that there is a necessarily right, correct, or wrong side of the street. Mm. So we have to make a choice. Government chooses to tell us what side of the street to go on and a number of other things. But a minarchist believes that the least amount of government is the best amount of government. And certainly when it comes to telling people who you can love, people who you can fuck, and what things you can ingest into your body, the government has no business in any of that.
I'm 100% with you. I just think that the sooner we accept that, the better off we will be. But the problem is that there's a lot of money in not only enforcing drug policy, but in incarceration and in all of it. But just think about how much money we'd make if we could tax it. You know,
think about how much money we would save if we just didn't do what we were doing
and didn't put all those people in jail. Yeah. I mean, how many lives have we ruined? Most people in the drug, from what I have read,
they create the criminal nature of drugs. That is the guns, the gangs, everything that is truly bad about it is created by the war on it.
That's right. Well, because you're when you've got
government creates
when
the
you have such stiff penalties, only people willing to shoot their way out of that penalty are going to take the risk. I mean, it's going to attract criminals, bad people who are willing to kill other people for the profit and whatnot. It's a very dangerous, high stakes thing. That's right. That argument, I think, again, seems to be gaining traction. I think there are more and more people that
agree regarding marijuana.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess meth and heroin and blow and stuff people look at differently.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
It's the cost of freedom.
It's the cost of freedom, man. I'm right with you on that.
The hypocritical nature of it is that how did we fund this is a rhetorical question for another conversation. How did we fund the war in Nicaragua? How did we fund the covert wars in Southeast Asia during Vietnam and Cambodia? And what's going on with the government of Afghanistan right now with respect to the growing of poppies?
It's a narco state.
That's right. He's the largest poppy producer in the world, and he's our boy.
Right.
We protect his fields.
You know, there's a lot of people, I guess, from what I've also read by credible sources, that a lot of people think Karzai is a heroin addict. Isn't that funny? For real, he was very erratic at times. And
I was in the Golden Triangle way back when, and people of that age would, in the tribes anyway, would lay down and they would talk about them. The old men, they would lay down and they would just lay down and smoke the pipe.
Oh, they'd be smoking opium.
Yeah, all day.
I bet. Well, it's been around forever back then. You know, isn't that funny?
But who created the opium wars in China?
The British.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could go on for hours, huh?
Well, I love
we might get locked up.
I love talking to you about this stuff. You know so much about it, and you know, I just fucking really appreciate what a warrior you are. I mean, you're a fucking warrior in this situation. You really are somebody who makes a huge difference for people who have nowhere else to turn. Look at this woman you're defending. She loses her son. She's a pariah in her own community because people are kind of blaming her. She's being blamed for a hit and run that didn't happen. I mean,
she's absolutely innocent, 100% innocent. And I won't try it in the press. We'll try it to 12 people. But how are we going to get a fair jury? This woman did pull over. She called her insurance company immediately. She told them that she was the victim of a hit and run. We have a witness who testified at the preliminary hearing that she, in fact, pulled over. We subpoenaed her cell phone records and the records of her insurance company that make clear that within 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, when I say one, two, three, because she was making phone calls from the side of the freeway where she pulled over. We have photographs shooting back. I wouldn't normally do this, but we'll try it to 12 people. But after this terrible tragedy that occurred, you know, the print media and various of
the terrible tragedy being her son killing all these people and himself. Yeah.
They put the pictures of the unfortunate victim of that accident that my client was involved with, who was a child, and she was in the hospital for 27 days and with tubes on her, and it was a terrible picture. And they put that picture up right next to, you know, the mayhem.
Mom from hell or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's and the comments and the vitriol that's coming at her, it's and she is in fact a victim in that sense. All she's trying to do right now is find a more we talked about this earlier. Imagine losing your son. Just in any circumstance losing your
especially
child.
Especially when he kills somebody in the house.
Yeah, and imagine never again being able to step foot into your home because you just can't.
Because you can't. It's also a police scene. I mean,
it's been cleared by now. But no, she's been in a motel, and they're looking for an apartment. She can't bring herself to walk back into that home, and that was her home. Everything that is her life. She has two small children. Imagine that. What is she going to tell her children? And there's nobody. She has no support except for me and some people that have flown in from Pakistan. It doesn't help that we live in a country where Pakistanis are looked at in a certain way.
Yeah, that's right. Of course. It's it's funny how your life can be going along really smoothly and, you know, your kid flips a switch or whatever happens and everything changes.
Well, that goes back to what we were talking about before, because I think that's the first question I'm going to ask the people that are going to sit on the jury. Do you believe that there's a reason for everything?
Yeah. And your idea is there doesn't have to be a reason for everything. There is the random.
Well, that's basic quantum theory.
Yeah.
We're living on a classical paradigm, and all of our religions are based on that classical paradigm. And the fact
cause and effect.
Is,
cause and effect.
Cause and effect.
Yeah.
And it's wrong. Hmm. That's what when
Einstein. That's a pretty profound idea. I mean, that's the idea. You're kind of taking the other side of that and having to convince people that have been sort of indoctrinated in that cause and effect.
Einstein couldn't even bring himself to it. Einstein said God doesn't play dice, and that's what he was talking about when he was trying to unify relativity with quantum theory.
Right.
And he couldn't bring himself to the truth of quantum theory. And
which was the random.
Which was the random.
What's interesting about quantum physics, and by the way, you guys, that just means subatomic. When you're dealing on a subatomic level, we're dealing with atoms and things like that. Quarks,
it's a fundamental different notion of quantum is different from relativity. It's just
yeah.
There's Newton's
physics, Newton's theory. You know, the world, which is the ether that we live in. That you know, where you drop an apple and you know it falls because of gravity and all those things and space and time and calculus and which the, you know that affects the world that we live in. And then there's the subatomic world where a lot of the rules that apply to the world that we live in, the world of matter we live in, where you know you can feel a book and you can see colors. The world that we live in, sometimes the subatomic world is the opposite. The reality of that world is actually the opposite.
Yeah,
right?
The macroscopic
the laws oftentimes are turned on their head.
The macroscopic world, in fact, that's what Einstein's general and special theory of relativity addressed was the Newtonian model, which is wrong. What you see, what you observe on the gross level that we see in the world we live in, it's just fundamentally wrong. And Einstein is basically relativity says it's based upon, it's relative, based upon the speed at which
time,
you're traveling.
Space and all that.
And what quantum theory says is that there is no cause and effect. There's only probabilities.
Are you then a relativist, my friend? Are
yes.
You are. Because, you know, you
but
know,
I'm not a relative. I'm a relativist for the universe, but I am a person who believes in you formulated. Otherwise, I can't find meaning in life. I will form an opinion as to what is right and what's wrong.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. And then you believe in right and wrong.
And then I will live by that until I'm proved wrong.
Okay.
And then I will not beat myself up because I was proved wrong. I will then live by that.
Otherwise, there's no
meaning in life.
Give me your idea of what's right and what's wrong. Child abuse.
Wrong.
Drugs.
What does that mean?
Right. Exactly. You got to put it into context. Putting people in jail for doing drugs.
Wrong.
Putting somebody in jail because they got into a car when they were under the influence of drugs and hurt somebody.
Right.
Okay. So if you're going to do drugs, it comes with responsibility. You believe
I don't
in
believe in
personal,
drinking and driving.
No, you believe in personal responsibility is what you
when
believe.
When you impede society's norm that then affects somebody else, that's when the state has a right to come
when you trample on someone else's rights.
That's right.
Okay, good.
And so then there are nuances to that. So, you know, those nuances have been played out over the last, 30 or 40 years with respect to smoking, for instance. So smoking in a public place can put other people at harm. So we ban smoking so that we don't put people in contact with secondhand smoke. Okay, great. But what about having a place where people can go smoke if they want to, and then you all know that that bar or that restaurant is a smoker's restaurant. You know, that's what I believe in.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There is a way to address these
right.
things.
Right.
So society has its rights.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more, my friend. I just wish there were more of you. I'm just glad you're out there fighting the good fight, and a guy as smart as you are with a heart like yours. I just it makes me feel a little better about the world. I wish you guys could see the man. He's wearing a gold tie, and I'm so jealous of your hair, you son of a bitch. We are at 50 minutes. I'm gonna
just end it?
Yeah, unless you want to talk about something else.
I could talk to you all day, but no.
Well, I love it. It's such a learning experience for me, man. I mean, I have a lot of people on this podcast. You know, I'll just say it on this podcast. You're a fascinating dude. You know, you bring up stuff on such a level that it's just so fun to listen to and talk to. I've been more quiet on this podcast, I think, than I've ever been because, you know, not only do I agree with everything you say, but you formulate very good arguments. I mean, you've been thinking about this stuff for your whole fucking life.
Yeah, I can't think of a time I wasn't. Yeah.
Well, and living it. Let's talk before we end with that, what you think the seminal moments of your life were that got you into this. What was it? Your education? Why fight this fight? Why law?
I wanted to be a lawyer since I was born. I was just born this way.
Oh, you were?
I was in third grade. I remember raising my hand. I went to Catholic school. And there was Father Delaney was pacing back and forth teaching us catechism, the Baltimore Catechism.
Explaining to us what catechism is for the
It's just the rules of God. God is great. God is good.
That's right.
And so I said, so let's talk about free will. And this goes to the question of sin, which goes to the question of crime and punishment, right?
Right.
And responsibility for things. So I simply raised my hand and I said, excuse me, I don't get it. When I believed, my God, I had a fucking 24-hour-a-day conversation with God. When I believed, up until I was 10, I fucking believed, you know? Yeah. I mean, just that's all I did. I was in a state of prayer all day long.
That's right. That's like Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. I think James Joyce's Irish Catholic upbringing.
My God, there's a great story with him. I'll digress a minute. You heard this story that he had the whole story up on the wall, and somebody walked in with a story and said, can you put this in your book? He goes, yeah, let me see.
Ah, he stuck it right. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I heard. Anyway, it's urban legend or Joyce
Ulysses.
Legend.
Ulysses.
Yeah, yeah, it was Ulysses.
That impossible fucking book. He was like, you know what? I'm just gonna confuse a bunch of people and have them teach courses on it. And teach in a circle.
Yeah,
fuck exactly. You, James Joyce.
But so I asked him. I said, so I am responsible for my actions, and I have to make decisions. And when I make the wrong decision, that's a sin. And some sins are big sins, and they are mortal sins. And you can never, unless you go to confession before you die, if you die with a mortal sin in your soul, you go right to hell. And back then, they still had purgatory, mm-hmm. and they had limbo. And so then a little sin got burned off for a while. And
I like that idea.
Without going through all that, I said, so, but God knows, he's all-knowing. He knows everything that ever was and ever will be. That's right. Well, then, I don't have any free will. How can I be held morally responsible for my actions?
You're talking about the age-old debate.
That's right.
You're talking about the age-old debate of whether or not it's enough just to have faith in Jesus Christ, or if your actions dictate your destiny. Yeah. That's always been manifest destiny versus, you know.
That's another that's subject for a different podcast.
God, is that, yeah. I've always believed that it's a question of what you do on this earth. I'm Catholic, but I just wasn't raised with enough religion. But I've just always believed that, you know, whether or not there's a God, you know, it makes sense to me that there is probably something out there. But the idea for me is I want to do the best I can on this earth with my talents to try to make the world a better place, at least in my feeble way, you know.
Well, I think it shows
inspiration.
I actually think it shows more character and more heroism on a philosophical level to get up and do the right thing every day if there's no heaven.
I agree with you, man. I agree with you. You're not doing it for a reward. You're doing it because it's the decent thing to do. You're doing it because you are born with a moral sense. We all know when someone's suffering.
Yeah.
I can see
even the bully knows.
Of course, you can see when you're putting somebody in pain. Your job should be to try to figure out a way to help them get out of it.
Yeah,
or at least provide inspiration.
And you know,
example.
What I've learned in my adult life was that the world isn't black and white, and not everybody necessarily was born or be given the same opportunities as me with great parents, etc. But I firmly believe that once you recognize what's right, and if you thought you were wrong in the past, you just stop and do what's right from then on. That's it. That's the answer. Mm. You don't have to figure anything out. You don't have to. There's no guilt associated with it. Don't blame yourself for the past. Just start doing the good and the right today.
I'm gonna end with that. That's great. We'll be having more of Vincent La Barbera. Count on that. And I appreciate everybody downloading it. We've been growing I mean, we're getting huge numbers now, and it's really exciting, and they seem to be growing. So I appreciate all you guys out there listening. And we'll have this man back because he's got a lot more to say. This is the Brian Callen Show. Thank you so much, everybody. Vincent Malavera, thank you for your wisdom and your heart.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.